This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Thank you all for coming. I'm Wendy Ely Jackson, a lecturer in Film and Media Studies in the College of Creative Sciences here at UCSB, and I am joined by my colleagues, Liz Yale Marsh, who is our lead producer. Let's give her a hand. Yeah. And our next guest needs no introduction. You've just seen him wrangling. This is the infamous West. Let's give him a hand.
Thank you.
I'm going to start today. I know some of these origin stories, but West, one of the questions that we often get is about horses down to the rim of the canyon. Why the Mustang specifically?
Well, for one, it's a very unique opportunity for domestic livestock to travel into the Grand Canyon. You know, they've typically got contract stock there, the donkeys that take people in and out of the Grand Canyon. So having stock that's outside of the national park and go down into the Grand Canyon is in itself very unique for that opportunity to even happen. But with Kara and the film, Mustangs or wild horses is what my specialty is working with wild horses. So all the horses that you guys saw in the film were once free-ranging, roaming wild horses that lived in America's landscape as wild horses. So they're very adept to that type of terrain. They're very strong and hardy. They're very conditioned for, you know, rough living, for survival. And the Grand Canyon is definitely a place that's it's very rough. So the Mustangs were very capable, very set up for that. And that was Kara was wanting to ride on a Mustang into the Grand Canyon. So that's kind of how I come about it. So it was a very unique opportunity for all of us.
You want to share with us how the Mustangs came to be? Because Kara had a different story going into what she wanted to do.
How me and my Mustangs got involved.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, what you don't know in the film or what you don't really ever see is that 45 days before the expedition, there was some issues with another contractor that was to provide the animals to go into the Grand Canyon. So 45 days before the launch of this great project, there was a little hitch in the giddy up of who was going to be providing those services. And so I got the phone call. I had 45 days to prepare myself, my team, my animals to do that job. That's a very, very high risk, high profile job to do that. It wasn't something you just, you know, go get grandpa's horse and sure, we'll go ride in the Grand Canyon. You know, it takes a specialized training to have that happen. So, but we were ready for it. And our training program is set up and designed to have that be easily safe on a short notice. And so, yeah, we hit the ground running. We had 45 days and we took it serious and we went after it. It was awesome.
So when I think of a Mustang, I think of just wildness, not really tameable. What was it that kept, I mean, the width of the area which you all were for making that descent was not very, you know, maybe inches, right?
Yeah.
So what gave you the peace, which we know that you were, you know, it was hard. You were maintaining your peace for Kara, but what made you say yes to doing that specific? Because it's not a lot of room for error.
That, first of all, I'm an adrenaline junkie. So as soon as I saw the project and was hearing about it, and I was like, the Grand Canyon, what? You want to ride horses into there? Like, I don't know if anybody's done that very much. So I was all about it from the challenge perspective. But that type of terrain and that type of extreme riding is very, very common to me and very, very familiar. So I do a lot of really extreme riding and training horses to do very dynamic, precarious, you know, navigating through things. So it was very, very much within my wheelhouse, within my comfort level, but also very challenging. So, I was just all about it. It was hard for me to not want to do the project.
Had you ever worked with anybody with a disability like Kara's before?
No, not to that level. And that was definitely a concern, something that we really looked at on my team, on my side of it, on the safety side, was what's the worst case scenario? And so we we really put together a safety plan as far as like what's the worst case that might happen. Let's plan for that times two and make sure we have that covered. So we put together a great safety plan to have her, whatever we needed to do.
Liz, oh, Captain, my Captain. So when let's talk about pulling this film together, right? From inception to post-production. I know what made me say yes, but what made you say yes?
So it was time meets opportunity. I have known Kara since 2012, and we can get into that later. But she had gone on this expedition, and I wasn't involved at all in the expedition, other than as a friend and supporter, sort of watching from afar. And she reached out to me in late winter of 20, late winter of 2020, and said, "Hey, I've been trying to get this film made about me for a few years now. I have all this footage. Do you have time to look at it?" And I said, "No, absolutely not. I don't have time to look at 100 hours of unsynced, no zero organization, like footage. Absolutely not." I think we all remember where we were come March of 2020. But all of a sudden, all of my productions were not happening anymore. And all of the films and television series that I was working on in my career were just ground to a complete stop. And I called her and said, "Well, I've got time to look at 100 hours of footage now." And so I started going through it. And within, the first few hours of looking through it, I called her and I said, "Oh my God, you have a film here." And so we put together a bunch of selects, and Wendy, you at that point, you had already, joined up with her and were trying to get it across the finish line. But funny enough, we didn't have a director. And so it's often in this industry, you kind of reverse engineer projects. You try and marry the right director with the right project. But never in my career did I have a film that was this far along that didn't have a director. And so I contacted a very good friend of mine and frequent collaborator, Celia Aniskovich, and I said to her, "I think I have a film that is the perfect story for you to tell." And she watched the footage as well, and it spoke to her on a very personal level. She lives with two hidden disabilities herself, and had often to that up until that time had been very concerned about losing work if anybody found out that she had a disability. She was concerned that that production is a very challenging space. There's no margin for error, and that if anybody knew, they would treat her like a liability. And she didn't want anybody else's assumptions of what she could and couldn't do to affect her own ability to live her dreams of what she wanted. Very similar to the story that you guys just saw with Kara. And so she and I spent those early months of the pandemic organizing those 100 hours of multi-camera footage and figuring out how to put a story together.
I just found my drive with all of that footage.
I keep opening this one box in my house, being like, "What's in this big box in this closet?" I was like, "Oh, it's all the
It's all the drives. It's all the drives. So, how many cameras do you remember? Plus GoPros?
So I want to say it was four cameras, plus everybody had GoPros all over them. There was all sorts of really incredible special rigging that was done. Justin Clifton, our cinematographer, was brilliant and very specialized in shooting in this terrain. What's really incredible about the team that was there on the ground is how specialized everybody was and how well they knew what they were doing. And this is certainly a specialized shoot. You can't just bring any old DP into the Grand Canyon and hope for the best.
That was something that I noticed. I mean, I hadn't met anybody until we got to the Grand Canyon before. I actually didn't even meet Cara until the day before in person. But when we got there and got meeting the crew, the different camera guys and the sound guys, and like these guys were like legit mountain rock climbing athletes. And like we would come riding around a corner and then there'd be a sound guy like hanging from his big toe on a cliff upside down, you know, and capturing the sound as we come by, with one of the camera guys on another cliff over here with his other fingernails holding on. Like these guys were, it was amazing to work with such an elite crew. It really was.
I call them the Jimmy Chin who did Nero and Free Solo of the Grand Canyon for sure. What were some of the big difficulties that you found? I mean, you met Cara just literally the day before the expedition started. So what were your immediate trepidations or any hiccups that you found that you're like, okay, this, we may not make this?
Nothing came up in the first meeting, and we did some test riding together the day before, kind of familiarizing her with the horse and getting that introduction and getting them kind of working together, and that went really well. But as you saw in the film, when we got to the cliff edge and when Cara looked off that edge, when that hit, that was the big moment of like, ooh, this is almost not happening. Like it was a moment to get through for sure. And then after she got hurt, you know, injured there a little bit, bumped her head, and that was some stuff to just deal with in live time, just right now, and what's the safety issue here, what's the next best thing to be doing. That was, for me, that was the moments that were real in live time. I kind of had my own kind of buy-in moment about 3 o'clock in the morning before we left. We were teed up to leave at, I think, at like 6 a.m. I was up with the horses about 3, wandering around in the night, and Sheriff, the horse that she was riding down into the Grand Canyon, I just kind of had to take him, and me and him went for a little walk about 3 o'clock in the morning out through the trees, and I just kind of have a nice little check-in right there. I was like, I need to know that we're doing this, that I just had to have a feel good, it happened, it felt good, and we were there, and I was like, all right, let's go do this. There's no looking back. Like, let's go.
Was there ever a plan B for you? If it couldn't
helicopter.
Be shared.
No, I just had plan A, plan A1, plan A12, plan A123. But my whole intent was safety first, but also just getting through the Grand Canyon. Stopping in the Grand Canyon just in itself is not safe. Mm-hmm. Holding still on that trail is at a higher risk than gently moving with the other traffic and everything that's going on. So stopping that whole caravan was just mind stretching to me, for the momentum to come to a stop and have all of my animals stop, and we had tourists passing us, we had all kinds of stuff going on that didn't make it in the film. But those are just some things we had to deal with just in live time, and just deal with them very calmly, very quietly, and just not let any energy get up. It was just, it just had to have a flow all the way through. That was really a lot to hold and to do. But
so when Cara hits her head, does Sheriff react? Can he feel her anxiety?
Yes, but also no. I mean, Sheriff and I, he was very connected to me. Like, I was directing every single footstep. I don't know if you guys noticed, but I'm, as far as I know, and the other crew that was there, I'm the only guy that's ever walked into the Grand Canyon backwards. Like, I walked that backwards so that I could keep eyes on my horses. I could see what was going on. I could watch Cara. I could watch the crew and just see everything. Like, I needed to see everything. So that was something I didn't practice walking backwards. Kind of wished I would have, but I didn't. And so after walking backwards for 10 hours, I mean, that was something I didn't know I'd need to do.
Wow. Liz, so you told us about how Celia came to be. You start to watch the footage. You notice that there's a story here. Let's talk. I know Celia's not here, but you guys are, I call you all the Sean Levy kind of Ryan Reynolds group. you guys
are like this.
Right. They're like this. For Celia, was there ever a moment where she said, you know, this is a lot of footage. I don't think I can find the story or the story that Cara may want to tell?
It's a really complicated question. So I think that what was really challenging was we got this footage 4 years after the expedition had happened, or we were really starting to get into it about 4 years after the expedition had happened. And there was a recollection of the lived experience that everyone had had on this trip, that the way, and everybody had different memories of it, and we talked to a number of different people who had been on the trip, and everybody had their own incredibly profound transformations in this experience, but they were all very personal, some of which were on camera and some of which were not on camera, many of which were not on camera. And so, and Kara had a very, she made this film, and she undertook this expedition for a very particular reason, which was that she wanted to prove something to the world. And that, and you see it in the film, when she wants to turn back, she can't, because she's taken on this mantle of what it is going to be to represent the largest minority in the entire world, which no single human can represent that many people. But I think that Kara maybe thought that she could, because she so deeply wants to be a beacon for the disability community. And so we really struggled at the outset of this, because we also wanted Kara to be a very active participant in the making of the film. I think in documentary, recently there's been a real shift. And you'll see in any language you ever see about this film, we do not call her a subject. We call her a participant. She was a participant, an active participant in the creation of this film at every step of the way. But it did take a lot of conversations and a lot of iterations to mine the footage and find the story that resonated with Celia as the director, myself as a producer, I know Wendy, you as a producer also, and that also was what Kara wanted it to be. And that took a while. We also, at one point, it was a feature. We were cutting it as a feature for quite a long time. And we ran into fundraising issues trying to make it as a feature. Everything just is more, you know, the score is more expensive, graphics are more expensive. It's just, that the edit is not more expensive for those filmmakers in the room. I'll say it takes pretty much just as long to cut a good short as it does to cut a feature, because it is easier to be long-winded than it is to be brief, as is evidenced by this answer. We ultimately felt that it was more powerful when we had to choose to be concise and we had to choose to be brief. And so that was a big moment when we walked away from it being a feature. And we had to leave a lot on the cutting room floor in order for it to become the story that it is now. But I'm really glad we did it as a short. It's become a really effective tool as a short. And I think a lot more people have seen it as a short than they would have as a feature.
Agreed. Let's talk about there's a lot of the crew in the water, right? Has our entire team seen the film?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, everybody has seen the film.
There's a lot. There's a lot there. But can you share the reason why YouTube and not to the other places where it could have gone?
Absolutely. So we really wanted accessibility to be baked into every aspect of this film, from the team that made it to at every level in production, in post-production, and in how we delivered it. So as you saw, the film has open captions. We only screen the film with open captions. I think we didn't get nominated for an Oscar, so now I can share the story. But when we did submit for, we were eligible to be considered for the Oscar. And when we submitted it, we got back a letter saying, We don't want open captions. Please resubmit it without the open captions, and you submit a separate closed captioning file. And we said, well, this is the only version of the film we have. This film is screened only with open captions. And they said, well, then you need to write us a letter saying that this is an artistic choice that overrides the Academy principles and rules. And so we submitted a very strongly worded letter about why it is not an artistic choice to make a film fully accessible. It should be just a matter of practice. So the film at every level, even things, some of you in the audience may notice, some of you may not notice, but for those who do, I hope it resonates that all of the fonts in the graphics are designed for readability for people with low vision. The sound design is designed for people with sensory hearing issues. So we really were mindful at every level. YouTube is the most accessible platform for everybody internationally. It does not live behind a paywall. We did not want people to have to sign up and pay $14.99 a month in order to see this film. And we wanted people everywhere around the world to be able to see it. And it's worked. We've been screening this film all over the world. People around the world have seen it. The only way actually you can see it without those open captions is that it is on YouTube in a way without, so you can put your captions in your own language. But that is the only option. But YouTube, it's been a wonderful place to premiere it. We premiered on International Day of People with Disabilities, which was December 3rd. And YouTube's a really amazing platform for creators.
So is there any, there's so much footage that's left behind. Is there, not me, you. I know we've all kind of moved along, but is there any opportunities for the public to see some of the BTS behind the scenes footage?
There is a little bit on our social media, so if anyone's interested, you can go on facingthefalls.com and you can link to our Instagram, and there is some behind the scenes footage there. Beyond that, not really. Unfortunately, cutting that costs money. Yes. And when you distribute on YouTube, no one is paying you. So we were able, really fortunate to be able to raise enough money to do the things that we did. But we were not, once we hit that threshold to get the film made, we didn't have extra money to throw in bells and whistles.
I would say there's bells and whistles that ended up on MSNBC. So there's bells, bells and whistles to it. How do you, for Cara now, this film, or at least the journey of the film, got her to be a speaker for not TED Women, and she was actually the closing night speaker for TED Women based on this exploration, this expedition that she did. How is this film moving the needle when we have these discussions around accessibility, people with disabilities? I too have one hidden disability that, for the same reason, Celia, I never disclose because of a lot of reasons. I don't want to be, not that I feel like I'm in a place where I would lose my job. However, you don't want to be seen differently. How is this movie, do you feel, move the needle to how people view people like Cara? And she has a very, that disease that she has, hereditary inclusion body myopathy, simply said is the onset of muscular dystrophy. And it starts with the feet, and it, as it progresses, it kills the muscles. So your heart is a...
What?
Right. So how has it moved the needle?
Yeah. When Celia and I started putting this film together in the edit, and when I called her, even from the very outset, I said, what if we make an action-adventure film? Free Solo had recently come out, and I had loved that film. And I said, you never see movies that are action-adventure films in the wilderness with women protagonists, mm-hmm. with anyone of color protagonists, and never, ever wants a person with disabilities, unless it is like being treated almost, I mean, we call it disability porn. And it's either like, how did you get this horrible thing that happened to you? And we're going to do an exploration of that. Or we're just going to sort of make a really saccharine hero story. Mm-hmm. And so we want to make something complex. We want people to walk away from this film going, wow, Kara is amazing, but not because she has a disability, because of who she is and what she accomplished. And so we were really excited about being able to put that out there into the world. And we talked a lot about, as we were making this, what it would have looked like for us as young girls to see this film and to see an action adventure hero who is a woman of color with a disability. And I think that that is what's moving the needle now. And we've really seen, we've seen so many people rally behind this film and want to be a part of it and helping to amplify it and put it out there in the world and host screenings because of how motivational it is. And, you know, Kara says, she was like, don't want to just inspire people. Inspiration is a four-letter word. I want to motivate people. And we have seen a lot of people feel really motivated. We come out of almost every screening with somebody coming up to us saying, okay, I'm going to go do the thing I've been avoiding doing. And that's really powerful. And that's, I think, something that we're really excited that's the message that's getting out there.
Hindsight is 2020. What would you do differently?
I would have been on the expedition. I know there's a lot of filmmakers in the room. So to speak sort of filmmaker talk, you know, we really, Celia and I had to treat this like it was an archive-based film, because to us it was effectively us getting a dump of archive in our lap and we had no map. We had Kara's recollections, and she herself hadn't gone back and watched all the footage. We had, you know, the various people on the expedition's personal recollections, but there was no one was like, oh, here's where everything is and here's how this unfolded. And, you know, there was one point where I said, could everybody just tell us what you did each day? And like, is there a map so we can try and figure out what goes where? It was a real excavation. So we really did, and we had to treat this like it was just a purely archival film and then figure out how to put those pieces together. Would it have been a different film had we been on the ground directing it in real time and being able to really have that story in mind? Absolutely. But I love the film it is now. And I think that, otherwise I'm really, I have no regrets about it.
Wes, have you thought about making this a rinse and repeat to maybe help other people with disabilities?
Yeah, you know, at the time when you're all high on the adrenaline and everything's still fresh, I was like, oh man, every year we're going to do that. I want to ride this canyon every year. Like, that was great. And then, you know, the next year comes and you're busy and have all the things, and you look back like, oh yeah, that was a massive project. And oh yeah, that's going to take a lot of whatever to get that done. Yeah, I told myself after we did that, I was like, I for sure want to do this. I want to come back where I can enjoy it as myself, you know, and just kind of be in the landscape and do it and not be that stressed. But have I done it? Nope. Nope. I've been back to the Grand Canyon. I just haven't rode in on a horse. But yeah, it would be a feat to do again. Absolutely. That'd be a life moment.
Let's do it.
Well, I will say, Kara has said she's going back. Kara is already planning her return to the canyon. She is going back.
That's another, so that's 150 miles. How much further? Another?
She crossed, Wes, you may know this better than I, but the crossing from rim to rim does not actually mean she crossed the full breadth of it, right? She crossed this way. Now she wants to cross this way.
Yeah, we went down and in and across and about halfway up the other side. And then we had a camp spot there and a few days of resting. And then we come back to the river. So we didn't do rim top across the top. But.
Now, I saw Cara, I guess that was in December. How is she now?
She's amazing. You saw the film ends that she was working at the White House. She is no longer working at the White House. She is back living in New York City, which she loves. She's very happy to be back in New York City. She has been traveling with this film and then traveling for her advocacy work, and really continues to be dedicated to promoting the work that she's been doing and that her peers have been doing. She's great.
So for I think Cara speaks what, 7 languages fluently,
something like that.
Yeah, she speaks, and she's lived in.
She doesn't speak cowboy.
She doesn't. She doesn't speak cowboy.
She's too fancy.
We got our own thing.
But I do know she's very, very passionate. She remains very passionate about how we see people with disabilities and the mediums that they lie on. And so I'm glad that I'm so happy that you're able to speak. Why YouTube and the accessibility? And when we think about, you know, I think Emily Zinn shared with you, we are a film and media studies program, and there's so many amazing scholars here at UCSB that really kind of study the form and the technical as well as the scholarship behind movies like this. What do you think would have happened if, let's just say, what do you think would have happened if that day came at Doc NYC never happened? If Celia never met Hillary?
Oh. What's been, well, we actually had a handful of really cool celebrities who wanted to EP this. We were actually really lucky that there were, as this film was finishing, through Celia and my relationships in the industry and having been around for a while making documentaries, there were a couple people who were quite interested in putting their names on it. But we really felt that Hillary and Chelsea Clinton's message around gutsy women. I don't know if anybody saw, they had a book called Gutsy and a series on Apple called Gutsy that is really about women who have had the guts to be incredible change makers. And we were really inspired by that and really thrilled when they decided to come on board at the film. At first, we thought maybe it was just going to be their production company, and but then we got the message that they both themselves had watched the film and wanted their actual names on the film as long as Cara was okay with that. They actually said they wanted to make sure that it didn't feel like it was detracting at all from Cara and Celia to have their names on the film. And we were honored to have their names on the film, and it's been really wonderful to have them be part of the promotion of it. Certainly for a film that we were releasing on YouTube with zero marketing budget. We got lucky that we, you know, as Wendy mentioned, we had a spot on MSNBC, and we did have, there was a really wonderful People magazine and a really wonderful Time magazine story. But I certainly think that having them behind it really helped amplify the message.
So there's a lot of filmmakers in the audience.
Yeah.
So what do you say to students that are working on their own docs now? Are we in the time of the independent? How would you suggest them work to get their film out there now?
I think the distribution model is changing rapidly, and what I say tonight could be different tomorrow morning. We're seeing a real constriction in the number. We had this, you know, big, so many platforms at one point, right? And now they're consolidating, and there are fewer sort of platform buyers than there were sort of in the heyday a couple of years ago. But there's also so many more ways to get a film out there and monetize a film, self-distributing. And I think that that if you can use, especially young people who are savvy with social media, we're old, we had to hire a social media expert and pay her a bunch of money to do things, and she's amazing and a genius. Many of you may just innately know how to do some of this stuff, or it's a second language. But using social media to help promote your film and being able to put it out there on YouTube, there are ways to monetize it via YouTube. I've seen films being distributed in parts via TikTok. I think there's a lot of really interesting ways to get it out there. The more you can network, the better. The more you can submit to film festivals, and if you can, go. We premiered this film at a film festival called Indie Shorts, which is a short documentary film festival, and they have a whole student section, and there were a ton of students there. And they were then, because we were all at the same parties, we were all networking and seeing each other. And, I do my best when students email me, if I've met them at a film festival and they have a film there, if they email, I try my best to answer. Certainly just going out there and putting yourself out there is really, really important, because you never know if you'll, you know, meet Hillary Clinton's head of her company and she'll want to put her name on your film.
What about filming? I'm always thinking, these students have lived through COVID, right? They are the ones that we lived through it, but they came through high school, and a lot of them finished their high school and maybe part entered college through COVID. Is an iPhone sufficient to do a documentary on?
Get a gimbal so it doesn't shake. I think that if you can make something beautiful and resonant, then absolutely an iPhone is sufficient. I mean, iPhones are some of the most powerful filmmaking tools imaginable. That said, you also want it to be artful, right? So just making sure that it looks good, sounds good, is probably even more important. Get a lav for $20 on Amazon, get a gimbal for $9, and yeah, throw your iPhone on it. And I think you can make something. I think that where I see sort of documentaries either breakthrough or not, is often in finding a story that people can really connect with. And I think a lot of times people approach documentaries as so issue-driven that you can't connect with it anymore. And I think that people need, especially now more than ever, people don't just wanna be hit with all of the things that they're being hit with on the news on a daily basis. The mm-hmm. world is bleak and hard enough right now. That's not what you want when you're coming to be entertained. But that also doesn't mean that we're only going to make really silly, gratuitous things. You can make things that are powerful and have a message that also are fundamentally entertaining and a little bit escapist. So I would say, certainly, if those of you who are interested in documentary and have issues that you're passionate about and want to tell, find the story in them and follow the character, follow the story as opposed to the issue.
And for those of you that may not remember, it's a three-act structure, right? The same things apply for narrative as it does for doc. You lead an inciting incident, you can bookend it, all of those things. I won't say it on here because this will end up on YouTube, but people don't go to the movies, or they don't watch things just to know that their life is horrible. They already know that. So there has to be some type of value thematically as well as messaging to your point. So there's a story about disability, but there is the participant of Kara and understanding her backstory. And there's a whole lot there. If you can go to TED and her speech is still there. It's 10 minutes, but it's the 10 minutes that truly blows you away. And she gives a little bit more exposition about her life. Do we have time for at least one or two questions, or?
Yes, let's do it. This is particularly for West. I was curious about the process of taking her down on the horse. Did you use a lead rope like the whole way, or were you just guiding the horse with the reins in your hands?
Great question. I led him all the way down, and I would have liked to have done that with like a lead rope and even had, you know, some space there. But the terrain and that trail and the other traffic that was there, I wanted my physical hand on that horse physically to feel and communicate and to feel forward and backwards and all the movement. And so I was contact hand on the whole time. Other than some of the more level places, I could walk side by side and we kind of relaxed and took a breath. And the plan was that I was going to ride in front of Kara and lead her behind me. And that, nope, didn't happen. We quickly made adjustments. It's like, nope, that can't be the way that needs to be. And so we made some changes. So, great question.
This one is also to West. The way it's framed in the documentary is that it looks like Kara and the horse were going to fall off those steeper steps almost at any point. And I was wondering how you overcame that in that moment.
The angles and the train that was shooting there, like we were very much like on the trail the whole time and various places of it, but we were I was never fearful or cautious, like, ooh, we might slip off the trail. Like that never come up. So we were well within the space that we had there on the trail. It was limited, but we were very secure. The horses were very clear on what their role and responsibility was to just, they just had to stay calm in the chaos for 10 hours. Yeah, it was incredible.
This is also a question for Wes. I was wondering if you would recommend for any of us to do that journey, just for the same experience.
On a horse?
Or just in general?
In general, absolutely. Like the Grand Canyon, like hiking into the Grand Canyon, like you're going to have to, you know, have some physical capacities to do that. But the Grand Canyon is a very hard place. It's a very magical place, and it's a very soul searching, soul connecting place. So yeah, if you've got the opportunity or if you can create and make the opportunity, 100%.
Thank you so much. I wanted to know when the decision to make the film fully accessible came in, at what moment in the production, you know, when is it from Kara? She says she wants to promote the social model of disability, or was it also from the director's perspective? As you say, she has a kind of hidden visibility. So this is just my question. Thank you so much for making this an accessible experience. Very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Kara certainly was taking that into account in the early days of the actual production. Although with the expedition, the hiring of everybody on that expedition was based on their expertise and safety in mind. And so it was really in post-production when we started putting the team together to assemble the film that both Kara and Celia, the director, and myself and Wendy came to that decision. And so really putting together an editing team, our composer, all the people who worked in post-production, sort of having a breadth of different lived experiences, and backgrounds, and then bringing sort of all of the disability considerations to the fore. And we had a number of different people within the disability community sort of consulting with us and helping us make sure that we were hitting all the things that we wanted to make sure that we hit. And by the way, I'll mention for all of the Grand Canyon questions, just for the filmmakers in the room, there are so many grants and film festival opportunities for documentaries that are focused on the natural world and that are highlighting, whether it's national parks or really just like American wilderness. And there's so many opportunities and not a lot of people do it because it's hard. So if this spoke to you in any way and you're like, I want to go do that trip, that is a great place to start for a film, and you may find some opportunities.
And it's important to note the Grand Canyon, there were crane rigs over certain portions of the Colorado River. These guys are, I call it the Nat Geo kind of team. So nothing was haphazardly. These guys knew the river. They knew every etch of a body between rocks of where you could hang someone or hang a camera. But I think as filmmakers, the river wild, I mean, if none of you have ever gone whitewater rafting, I was a professional until I was in the Colorado River, and I got thrown off, and I was about 16 feet deep, and the boat had passed over me, and had my husband not jumped out and pulled me from the rocks because my legs got lodged. So be careful in doing that. I now know that he actually loves me. It's not just for the Prudential insurance. Thank you. He's here, but it's a great opportunity to make the film that you and tell the story that you want to tell. And that's really what we want you to, no matter how arduous it might seem. This film took 10 years. If you were here when Sam Pollard, who's also one of our executive producers, was here and you saw he finished a film, it took 30 years to do the Max Roach and the drum also Swing. So, but when it's yours, it's not really a matter of time. It's seeing it come to fruition. And for Cara is like four exhausts on the back of a Porsche. She's going to push, and I'm so glad that she did. Thank you so much. I appreciate you all.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.